I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the last day of June, June 30th. Bill McKibben is our guest this hour. Bill has recently composed and published letters to President Obama and to Hillary Clinton concerning climate change. He begins his letter to President Obama. I feel a little awkward writing a letter to you, perhaps because I helped organize the largest demonstrations outside your house during your residence there. It's odd to write to someone when the closest you've ever come to them is being chained to the fence outside their home protesting the Keystone Pipeline. Bill McKibben is with us this hour. He is the author of The End of Nature, the first book about global warming for a general audience that was written nearly 25 years ago. He has devoted a whole day recently to reading Pope Francis's just released encyclical on climate change. He has quite a history with the environmental movement. He is an environmentalist who in 2014 was awarded the Right Livelihood Prize, the Alternative Nobel. His book, The End of Nature, regarded as the first book for a general audience about climate change. It's appeared in 24 languages. He's written a dozen more books. He is the founder of 350.org, the first planet-wide grassroots climate change movement, which has organized 20,000 rallies around the world in every country save North Korea. He spearheaded the resistance to the Keystone Pipeline and launched the fast-growing fossil fuel divestment movement. He's also author of Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Bill McKibben, and here's how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we love to read your messages, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Bill McKibben, nice to talk to you again. Hi, sir.
Well, what a pleasure to be back with you. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. There's some kind of big electrical storm going on up here in upstate New York, so I don't know how well the phone line's going to do, but let's hope.
Let's hope. I think with you on the air, it'll be fine. We'll carry through this hour. Let's start with this letter that you wrote to President Obama. I've had this image of you being chained to the fence outside the president's home during the Keystone Pipeline. It seems to me as though with the president vetoing this legislation, and we'll talk about where it stands right now, that that protest was an important one.
Well, I hope it was. I mean, the story of Keystone's not done yet, and he hasn't officially put the kibosh on the whole thing, and we're waiting to hear, but we have for 4 or 5 years now held it from being built, and I think it actually has been one of the many kind of important turning points. Ever since then, pretty much every big fossil fuel project has drawn a lot of resistance, I think because we sort of demonstrated that they could be beaten, and we've been trying to help in all the ways that we can. I mean, I was just in the Twin Cities for a big rally a couple weeks ago. Many, many thousands of people led by indigenous people there demanding, you know, that not only Keystone but some of these other pipelines be halted down from the tar sands. And this has become a big movement, and it's spread to other continents. We're fighting big coal mines in Australia. We're fighting now to keep carbon in the ground in every place we can, because the scientists tell us 80% of what we know about has to stay. The coal and oil and gas has to stay underground, unburnt, if we have any hope of dealing with the climate crisis we're in.
Let's talk a little bit about, you praised the president in the letter for the decision he made to block limits on power plants. Let's talk about the Supreme Court decision yesterday that blocks those very limits.
Well, the Supreme Court was on a slightly different thing. It was about other regulations that deal with mercury emissions from power plants. As it turns out, power plants have made most of the changes they'd need to deal with those mercury emissions. And as usual, it's cost far less than they said it would, and so on and so forth. I don't think it's going to do much, that Supreme Court decision, to stop the downward trend of the coal-fired power plant, because every month's issue of Science and Nature makes it that much clearer just how dangerous it is to be burning this stuff.
You say in this letter to the president, as you've learned more about how Washington works, Bill, you've understood better some of the paths the president took and some that he didn't. What did you learn as you understood Washington better?
Well, look, the president's obviously under huge pressure because he's got a Republican Party that just whatever he says the opposite. I mean, if he were to, say that today is Tuesday, there's a number of people who would insist that it was no, in fact, Wednesday or Monday or something. So there's limits to what he can do. I mean, the things that all economists have said we should do is put a price on carbon to reflect the damage it does in the atmosphere, and that would rationalize this process and help speed the transition to renewable energy. We can't do that because of Congress, so the president is left to doing things he can do, and he's done some of those. He did a good job in raising mileage regulations. On the other hand, he's missed all kinds of opportunities. He offered Shell a permit to go drill in the Arctic. If you think about that, it's just craziness. I mean, climate change has melted the waters of the Arctic, that our big oil companies, instead of looking at that as a signal to get into the energy business instead and start building solar panels, that instead they looked at that and said, now that that's melted, it'll be easier to drill for yet more oil. That's pretty much the definition of painful irony. And the president has gone right along. He's also approved huge new sales of coal leases in the Powder River Basin that would deliver three times as much carbon to the atmosphere as what he's saving with his regulations on power plants. He's even talking about offshore drilling off the Atlantic coast now, as if the lessons from Katrina weren't still vivid in people's minds. So, it's a very, very mixed record at a moment when we desperately need someone to be all out in the lead on the greatest crisis that human beings have yet run into.
Mm-hmm. You remind us, which probably most people aren't aware of, Bill, that the U.S. has passed Saudi Arabia and Russia to become the world's biggest oil and gas producer.
Yeah, the explosion of drilling in places like North Dakota on the president's watch and the spread of fracking around the country with the active complicity of the EPA has gotten us deeper in the hole that we're in. I mean, look, climate change is a huge hole, and the first rule, really, of holes is when you're in one, stop digging. But we've tended to dig harder, and that's why we desperately need the president to call a halt to at least some of the digging over things like the Keystone Pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
The carbon stuff, I mean, look, is just out of control. When this president took office, the summer Arctic was still more or less intact. Then we've had these crazy years of enormous melt. In his tenure, we've seen the hottest year in American history by far, 2012, with all the damage that did to grain growing across the heartland. We've seen this mammoth, epic drought in California. We've seen just one crisis after another, and it doesn't slow down. I mean, May was the wettest month that America's ever had, and flooding from one corner of the country to the other. This is the kind of thing that just keeps accelerating as we pour more carbon into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the Pope's encyclical. You've read all 183 pages. You talk about the heart of the encyclical, that it's a remarkable attack on the way our world runs on rapidification of modern life. What is rapidification of modern life?
Well, that's the word he uses, at least that's the translation of it. Look, this encyclical is a completely remarkable document, and I would urge people to read it instead of just reading the news stories about it. It's widely available. It reminds me a lot in certain ways of the work of people like E.F. Schumacher and Wendell Berry, in that it's a thoroughgoing critique of much of what we do in our world today. It's impersonalization. It's the trend toward putting people out of work in the name of making things ever cheaper. The kind of basic question of whether we're a society, a kind of collective group of people, or merely a bunch of individuals? And the Pope has a great deal to say about all these things, and the answers are underlined by the physical facts that he cites. I mean, the fact that the planet is warming out of control is an indictment of the system under which we live. It kind of puts the argument to rest about whether we can just keep going as we're going, because clearly physically we can't. And so the Pope has a lot of interesting suggestions about what we might do differently.
And what kind of weight does he carry, Bill?
Well, who knows? I mean, he's clearly probably the most prominent person in the world, right? It's hard to think of anybody else that more people kind of know of. Clearly, he's the leader of 1.2 billion Catholics, but sometimes I think that it's non-Catholics are at least as excited by his papacy as Catholics are. All kinds of people of goodwill, I think, are looking to him as a kind of leader at just the moment that the world very much needs a leader.
I know that you are supporting Bernie Sanders. You introduced him in Vermont when he kicked off his campaign. Why are you supporting him, and what is it about his campaign that seems to be attracting a lot of attention and a lot of followers, Bill?
That's a good question. So I confess I'm sort of started supporting him because I'm from Vermont, right?
Right.
There's a long tradition in America of favorite son politics and things, but he's been the best. He got the best rating of any senator dealing with climate change. In the most recent sort of scorecards and things, he's been completely amazing about helping in all these fights. But that's just, you know, since those of us in Vermont have gotten to see him for a long time, that's just par for the course. When I introduced him, I said, this guy is a very strange politician in that what you see is what you get. Don't expect that there's something hidden there that you're going to get some extra thing that's not there. Don't try to project your fantasies onto him. He is exactly what he is, and he's been that way for 40 years. And that seems to be such a novel idea in American politics that I think it's attracting an enormous number of people. I mean, look, we're all spun out, you know? I mean, I don't know about you, but it's just exhausting listening to people explain endlessly their positions and by what the latest poll numbers show or what their focus groups are showing or what their PR advisors are saying, whatever. Bernie just says the same thing over and over and over again, and it's a thing that we probably need to hear, you know. He says the climate crisis is out of control. He says it doesn't work to have a society where the six heirs to the Walmart fortune have more assets than the bottom 45% of the country, where inequality just keeps getting worse and worse. We got to do something about this stuff. And, it doesn't surprise me that it's drawing a response. You know, he wins huge margins in Vermont, and he wins them in the most conservative and Republican parts of the state because people realize that he actually is that rare politician who really is for the little guy.
Bill McKibben is our guest this hour, and we're going to welcome phone calls, 800-486-8655. He recently published letters to President Obama and to Hillary Clinton. He wants to make her make history by changing the nation's energy paradigm. Bill has a piece in the current issue of The New Yorker as well, why the rise of green energy makes utility companies nervous. Innovative, eco-friendly technology is now cheap enough for everyday use. Bill, of course, has been working in this field for a long, long time. We want to remind you, he, in 1989, wrote The End of Nature, regarded as the first book for a general audience about climate change. He's the founder of 350.org. He has spearheaded the resistance to the Keystone Pipeline and launched the fossil fuel divestment movement. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. One line is open for you right now. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Email talk@WPR.org. Twitter @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bill McKibben is with us this hour, and we go to phone calls for him, starting with Judy in Madison. Hey, Judy.
Hi. I want to first of all thank Bill for giving us, with Keystone, a focus that we could organize around, because that's, I think, when things started to turn around. I was arrested in D.C. I was in the Twin Cities with 5,000 people a couple of weekends ago. I was hoping that Bill would be able to address the situation in Wisconsin. We have bomb trains in La Crosse going down the Mississippi, going through Milwaukee, right close to residences. We've got the tar sands, Enbridge tar sands freeway going right through the middle of the state. There's frac sand mining over on the west side of the state. And then, of course, our utilities are trying to roll back rates and socket to solar, people with solar, and giving breaks to high users.
Yeah, you've laid out some of the questions really straight on. All the upper Midwest is having to deal with the kind of overflow of oil out of the Bakken and especially out of the tar sands, and it's causing all kinds of problems. New pipelines all the time, these oil trains, and I'm glad that you brought up these questions around utilities. That's what I was writing about in the New Yorker recently. And though I focused on the situation in Arizona more than Wisconsin, it's sort of what's happening all across the country, a kind of pushback against solar power. You know, the really rapid fall in the cost of solar panels, 75% in the last 5 or 6 years, has been destabilizing. All of a sudden, it's cheap enough for all of us to start putting to use in a serious way. And that scares the daylights out of the utilities, who have taken all sorts of steps to try and slow it down or prevent it from happening. And I'm glad that there's a kind of rising citizen vigilance against this in all parts of the country, but it's going to be a real fight, I think.
Let's talk a little bit about that New Yorker article. You write that you've traveled the world writing about and organizing against climate change, but standing in the Porkowski's kitchen in Rutland, Vermont, and looking at their electric bill, you felt a fairly rare emotion, hope. Why did they give you hope, Bill?
This was just a nice house, you know, in a bad neighborhood in a kind of gritty city. Just a house, and the guy drives a school bus, and his wife's a special ed teacher, and they don't have a lot of money. And what happened was the local utility came in and made them one of their first e-homes. They stuffed the house full of insulation. They placed the furnace with an air source heat pump. They put a solar panel in the garage. The Borkowskis paid all of this. They financed it through their electric bill. But their energy savings were so great that their electric bill went down from the first month. And it was a reminder that we have a tremendous sort of pool of money in the amount of energy that we waste all the time that should enable us to make this transition off fossil fuels with great speed if we can get the vested interests out of the way. And in this case, you know, the vested interests are the fossil fuel industry, who don't like this transition. That's why we have to have this, you know, huge battle all the time over things like Keystone. In a rational world, given the alert we've been given by the scientists about climate change, we'd all be working hand in hand as hard as we could to make this transition happen speedily. It's going to be hard and expensive in the best of circumstances, but it's darn near impossible with the richest industry in the world trying to keep it actively from happening.
Thank you, Judy, for your call. Steve in Madison is next. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for accepting the call. This regards why Sanders is right now a better candidate than Clinton is because he's not bending over for corporate America like her husband did and like the president did yesterday with the fast track. I truly think that what's going on with the what you stopped with the oil trying to be pulled out of the ground and piped all the way down to Texas, I believe. That could have gone to Vancouver, except the analog to Congress in Canada, they wouldn't allow it. They knew it would happen. They knew their water would turn bad.
Bill.
Yeah, well, there's been a great movement across Canada. I mean, actually, the Canadian government's been in certain ways worse on this stuff than the U.S. Harper, the premier of Canada, is out and out, you know, captive of the fossil fuel industry. But Canadian activists, led as usual by First Nations people, have done an amazing job, and they've blocked, as the caller points out, the pipeline to the west. Now there's a huge fight over a pipeline from the tar sands to the east, to the Maritimes, through Ontario and Quebec. I'll be in Toronto on Sunday for a big, massive rally there just around these issues that people like the writer Naomi Klein are helping to organize. So it's an exciting moment, and you're right. Senator Sanders is one of the people kind of tapping into some of that energy. It's really interesting to watch, and the most important statistic so far is that he's raised, $8 or $10 million, $43 at a time, and that's the average contribution. Nobody gives $43 expecting a favor as a result. You give $43 expecting that the guy you elect won't do favors for people, and that would be a new world.
Wilhelm on Facebook wants to know more about a decision in a Dutch court this week that allows environmentalists to sue the state for having accepted international climate agreements and then not fulfilling them.
Yeah, this is fascinating. And I don't know what precedent it holds in this continent, but a Dutch court found that the Netherlands government was not doing enough to meet its international commitments around climate change, and the court system says that they're going to force the government to do that. Holland has kind of a front row seat for all of this change. If there's any place in the world that should be focused on the fact that the sea level is rising, it's Holland, and I think that court decision is a signal that parts of that society really are. There was also a decision in a Washington state court last week on a suit filed by a bunch of young people there demanding that the state of Washington take more action to protect their future. There are similar cases in a lot of state courts, but Washington is the first one to get a ruling, and it was a good ruling. It'll be appealed and things, but it too, the courts are telling the state to take more action.
Steve, thanks for your call. Walt in Fort Atkinson. Hi.
Good afternoon, Kathleen and Bill. I had a question about coal, but first of all, I just wanted to support what Bill said about the cost of regulating and controlling emissions, mercury emissions from coal power plants. It was less than what was stated it would be. And that was my experience as I'm a retired mechanic. I started working on cars before there were any pollution controls, and then my occupation right through all of the emission controls till just a few years ago. And in every case where there was government regulation that required better fuel mileage, lower pollution, and the switch to R134 from R12 refrigerant, in every case, the manufacturers just whined and bellyached about the sky is going to fall, it's going to cost too much, and the cars won't work. And in every case, they were wrong. Cars last longer. They perform better. The cost is not bad at all, and your air conditioning works fine. Everything
Detroit
said it would
be too expensive to put seatbelts on.
Was great.
Detroit didn't want to put seatbelts on for years. It would be too expensive. I mean, this is always the case. Industry always whines and moans, and then when they get around to it, engineers do a good job of showing you can do good things for a reasonable price.
And thank you so much for the call. Can we spend a moment talking about fracking? I want to know about the scientific evidence that is equating some of this fracking to the number of earthquakes, which really seems so high in certain states in this country. We're putting up with these earthquakes, which some are saying may definitely be related to fracking.
There's no real question. Oklahoma, which has never had any seismic activity, is now the leading. It's past California last year as the earthquake capital of America. There are earthquakes rumbling through virtually every day, and it's because they're injecting all this wastewater from fracking into deep underwater, underground wells where the pressure is screwing up the subsurface geology. Fracking was sold as a kind of way to get this bridge fuel, natural gas to a clean energy future, blah, blah, blah. And it turns out to be a disaster in almost every respect. The biggest of those disasters is that when you frack, you release a lot of methane into the atmosphere. Methane, unburned, is a greenhouse gas more potent than carbon dioxide. And so there's a lot of studies in the last 2 or 3 years from places like Cornell, indicating that fracking may well be worse than coal. Natural gas may be worse than coal for global warming. It underscores the fact that we need not a bridge to the future, but we need to actually make the leap to renewable energy. And the good news, as I say, is the price of that has come down so dramatically that it's no longer a scary leap. It's now a really doable thing.
Mm-hmm. And you praised for the president in your letter for some of his efforts on behalf of renewable energy.
Yeah, the president has done some of what we need to do. He gave, in the original kind of the recovery money, there was some money that went to green energy kind of stuff. The Republicans made a big deal out of the failure of Solyndra, but 99% of those investments paid off really well. And in fact, the Solyndra factory is now owned by the people from Solar City, which is the fastest growing rooftop solar installer in the country. So even that's turning out okay. But we haven't yet seen, let's be honest, the kind of World War II scale of effort that we really need to quickly turn this country into a renewable energy powerhouse. That would take a different kind of focus than we've seen so far from the president. And I think, truthfully, it'll await the next presidency for that to be a real possibility. The next president will be the first one who took office with cheap solar panels as a fact of life, and I hope it'll really drive their understanding of the possibilities.
Mm-hmm. We go to Patricia in Baraboo next. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for all your work, Mr. McGibbons. And recently I became aware of the war games going on in the Navy war games in the Gulf of Alaska, along with the permit to drill. I mean, to me it was just a very upsetting week. And I, beside calling the White House every day and, talking to people, it gets so frustrating just as a common, ordinary person, But I was wondering, is there any effort out there to convince the fossil fuel industry to be part of the creative solution? Because if it's all based on economics, and we know that it is, we just need to think differently,
This is just the right question. Look, there's no way in the short run to convince the fossil fuel industry to change its stripes. People have tried. They've engaged, as it were, with the Exxon and Chevron and all the rest, and they've been rebuffed. They say, we're going to keep on doing what we're doing. Exxon spends $100 million a day looking for more hydrocarbons, even though we've got far more than we can possibly safely burn already. It's crazy. And Shell, as I say, heading to the Arctic is the kind of perfect, underlines that in the most dramatic way. The good news is that there is a very robust now effort to get institutions to divest from fossil fuels, to sell their stock in these companies and put real pressure on them. And that movement is working. They're beginning to feel that pressure. I noted the other day that Peabody Coal the biggest coal company in the world, in their letter to that they have to file every year with shareholders about the prospects for their business, said one of the material risks going forward is the power of this growing divestment movement, which now has colleges all over the world, places like Oxford and Stanford. It has religious institutions, the Church of England, the Unitarians, the United Church of Christ. Last week, the Lutheran World Federation joined in. It has city, state, local governments. It even has, and maybe this was the biggest, the two biggest turning points so far, has the biggest insurance company in France, one of the biggest investors in the world, started divesting earlier this year, saying that the risk, financial risk of this carbon bubble, all this extra carbon, was too great. And last year, the Rockefeller family, the first family of fossil fuel, you know, the heirs to the original oil fortune, said they thought it was no longer fiscally prudent nor moral to be invested in fossil fuel and withdrew their investments. That's a pretty powerful statement about the moment that we're in. We're at the beginning of the end of the fossil fuel age. The only question is how quickly we can get off it, if we can get off it in time to keep the worst projections about climate change from coming true.
Mm. You've been doing this work for so long, Bill. When you look at the book, The End of Nature, 1989, you wrote that. Do you go through hopeful signs and hopeful periods and discouraging periods? Where are you now in that regard? This is a long time to be on this issue, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, I mean, look, at a certain level, it's a very daunting thing to spend all that time on because it's, by its nature, inevitably discouraging. Watching the disintegration of the Earth's physical systems is very hard because one knows, I've traveled enough now around the world to know just how much that affects the poorest and most vulnerable people on the planet. I mean, you know, we watched in May when India had its deadliest heat wave ever.
Yes.
Just last in Pakistan, you know, people literally just keeling over in the streets of Karachi and dying. That's horrifying to watch. But, you know, there also is a powerful movement finally. It's surging up everywhere. And the papal encyclical on this was a kind of a high watermark so far of that movement. I think at this point, you know, if nothing else, the Pope has made it clear that this has got to be the issue on which all people of goodwill concentrate as hard as they can for the next while. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether we got started in time to really turn it around or not, but darn it, we're trying hard, and it's that part of it is deeply, deeply encouraging to me.
Patricia, thanks for your call. Carl in Madison, hi.
Yes, thank you for this wonderful program. Bill McKibben, I'm with 350 Madison. We recently marched up to St. Paul and joined you. I was holding a giant octopus that represents the tar sands pipelines that stretch across the Great Lakes. And, you know, when we were in that parade, we couldn't really tell where we were, how many people are really here, you know. And then the parade ahead of us marched up the hill as it headed toward the Capitol, and you could see 5,000 people around one subject, tar sands in the Great Lakes, and that willingness to hold on tight to this beautiful, glittering resource that we have here in this region of the country that supports, gosh, there's no end to the support that the Great Lakes provide for this nation and beyond. And I wanted to ask two things. Number one, I wanted to thank you for really embodying, you know, you started at Middlebury, you had some burning questions, there was nobody really moving on this issue, and now I would say across the Great Lakes, the dialogues we're having, there's a really powerful movement building, and like you, I wonder if it's in time. I wonder if the damage that we've done is going to overwhelm us. But here we are in this opportunity to use this lifetime to tackle something. And I think your life has shown that there isn't anything more powerful than we could be tackling than the opportunity to hand our children a livable planet. So first, thank you. And second of all, in this regional fight here in the Great Lakes states where we're trying to keep this tar sands poison out of our aquifers, do you have advice on the next best step for a region that is really finding its voice to put this particular fight over the top and get more people involved and really, really turn the tide on this issue.
Well, I think that y'all are doing just the right things. I mean, I think your analysis is exactly right. There's this now sprawling fossil fuel resistance around the world. One of the things that's nice about it is, in a sense, that it doesn't have a great leader. There's no Dr. King of this fight, you know. And that, I mean, if there was, maybe that'd be good, but this, we make a virtue of necessity. Since there isn't, it's great that we have this endless amount of grassroots leadership. One of the things that I think that's really powerful and important is the quick rise of indigenous communities at the forefront of this work. You know, they have been saying for a very long time that if we kept on the path that we were going on, it was going to be trouble. And it turns out that they were absolutely right, that their understanding of the world, and they were, after all, pretty good at inhabiting this continent for long periods of time, turns out to be correct. And so their leadership's been really key. The other thing that just we've got to keep stressing over and over again is that we don't need to be doing any of this. You know, 25 years ago, it was harder to see what the alternatives were. We knew we couldn't keep burning fossil fuel, but we didn't quite know what to do instead, because, you know, things like solar power were still expensive and difficult and small scale. But that's not true anymore. I mean, we look to places like Germany, which is on a higher latitude than the Midwest, you know, and there were days this summer when the Germans got 80% of their electricity from the sun.
Hmm.
The Danes last year got 40% of their electricity from the wind. It's not like Denmark has some monopoly on wind. There's plenty that blows across the plains, and we're beginning to capture it, but we need to do it on an ever greater basis, and we can. And when we do, and this is one of the things that I think really attracts people now to this fight, when we do, when we build those turbines and put up those solar panels, we're no longer having to send off a check all the time to the Saudis or the Koch brothers or whoever else. We begin to exert some democratic control over one of the most important things in our life, our energy supply.
So this is what you're referencing in the other big letter to Hillary Clinton, where you ask her to make history by changing the nation's energy paradigm.
I think I say in there that, you know, there were two moments in the last century when presidents really marshaled technology to do what needed to be done. FDR, after Pearl Harbor, when he turned the nation's factories on a dime to making planes and ships, and JFK, when he marshaled all our resources to put a man on the moon. And I think the writerly thing I said was that would Hillary Clinton become president, and would she be the one to do the same thing on renewable energy, then HRC would join FDR and JFK in those list of illustrious initials. We shall see how it all plays out.
We shall see how it all plays out. Bill McKibben is our guest this hour, and we're welcoming more phone calls for him, 800-486-8655. We're talking about his recent letters to Hillary Clinton and to President Obama. We're talking about the Pope's encyclical. We're talking about the rise of green energy, his piece in the current issue of The New Yorker. We're talking about the Keystone Pipeline and fracking and, well, a number of issues that are important when it comes to the future of Earth and when it comes to our changing climate. 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls for Bill McKibben. This is Pete in La Crosse is next. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Bill. Hey, me and some friends were also in the tar sands rally, typically about 25 feet or so behind a black octopus, but that didn't help me find myself in any of the pictures. The reason why I'm calling is, as we all know, there was about 5,000 people there, but the very next day, the article in that published by the Associated Press reported that many hundreds of people marched. So my question to Bill is underreporting just a part of changing the world? And are there other news agencies that are better or worse? You know, can you kind of rate the news agencies on their truthiness? That would be helpful. Thanks.
Thanks, Pete.
Organizers of this thing, it just sort of always seems to happen. But the good news is that the numbers, you know, no matter who's doing them, the numbers just keep going up and up and up. We had 400,000 people in New York City last fall for this huge climate change march, and that was the Fox News estimate, so who knows what it really was. There'll be more than that marching in Paris in December when the world gets together for its next attempt to hammer out some kind of international agreement. So, you know, that's good. The numbers are growing, and that's what movements need. And as for the media, you know, increasingly we have the ability to make some of our own. Nobody would cover the tar sands thing when we started the Keystone stuff in 2011. And yet we were able to get the word out. You know, the rise of the Internet has changed the rules some. And so it would be nice if everybody was covering everything the way they should. But there's no use holding your breath until that happens. And in the meantime, we spread the word as effectively as we can. And we do it from places like 350.org.
Judy in Fitchburg writes, in Wisconsin, scientists are being laid off. In the Department of Natural Resources, the executive secretary of the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands was told by the state treasurer and state attorney general not to speak about global climate change. What does that mean for citizens in the state? Do we have to change state government if we're to have any chance of enacting state public policies that are realistic about the science of climate change?
You're asking me to wade into the middle of Wisconsin politics.
Well, why not? You've waded into the middle of a lot of things, Bill.
you know, from a distance, it doesn't look like the governor of Wisconsin's all that interested in these questions. Or if he is interested, it's in doing the bidding of the Koch brothers. Some of us remember the famous prank phone call when he thought he was talking to the Koch brothers at the height of the kind of unrest there a few years ago, and he was yes-siring who he thought were the Koch brothers, and I'm afraid that sort of exemplifies his approach to these issues. We're going to get to make some fateful decisions as a country before long, and one hopes that that we won't go in the direction of denying science, pretending physics doesn't exist, because even when truths are kind of difficult and painful to deal with, it's much smarter to deal with them than pretend that they aren't real and then have to deal with the consequences later.
Sarah in Madison, hi.
Hi. I was one of the 1,100 people who got arrested with you in 2011.
Sure are.
So I think that we do have a leader. Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Okay. Anyway, so my question really is, though, that in Vermont, you all were able to get the Green Mountain Power to be engaged in this process, and Madison Gas and Electric is just increasing the amount that people who have solar have to pay as a base, and there's no local funding. And I'm really wondering what kind of efforts you made or Vermonters made, not just you, to get them engaged in this so that maybe we can steal some of those ideas.
This actually, I'm afraid, in this case, it was largely the result of the power company itself, Green Mountain Power, Vermont's main utility, surveying all their customers, and what the CEO said, we found that what customers wanted was environmentally friendly energy at no extra cost, and so that's what we're trying to give them. And they've worked really hard to do it, and it's not just around solar energy, it's also around this really important question of figuring out how, on a massive scale, to retrofit homes with the newest technology so that they use lots less energy. And once we've done that, then solar power gets even easier because you don't have to provide as much juice. So it is, you know, it's difficult right at the moment. There aren't very many really good utilities in this country. But there are beginning to be enough examples for people to look at. And so if I were you, I would, send your utility executives in the direction of the homepage of places that are doing it right. Green Mountain Power is one, and people are also looking at the utility in Hawaii seems to be doing an interesting job, too. And, of course, we have plenty of examples overseas. The thing that scares the utilities is it's not clear what their business is going to be as people start putting solar panels on their rooftops. They need to be the people who decide to kind of own that transition to help make it happen, to be the people who regulate the grid. But that's a perfectly good and useful thing. It's just not what utilities have made their money doing in the past.
Thanks, Sarah. Al, Land O'Lakes. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for the show. Once again, you give me hope for our species. I've been a big fan of Bernie since his Playboy article in November 2013, in which I get for the articles. And he starts out by saying, big business is willing to destroy the planet for short-term profits. This is incomprehensible. But skipping down, he talks about ExxonMobil. They had a bad year in 2009. They only made $19 billion in profit. They paid nothing in federal taxes. But they got a $156 million refund from the IRS. Bank of America operated 200 subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands in 2010. It got a $1.9 billion rebate from the IRS. This is a list of about 15 companies that paid nothing or very little in taxes. Many of these institutions, Bank of America, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, were actually bailed out by the American people. They were wonderfully proud Americans when they came for their welfare checks from the American people after the bailout. They all went to the Cayman Islands.
Bill.
Well, look, the part of this that I know the most about is the fossil fuel part. And there the subsidies are enormous and completely insane. You know, think about the fact that we give huge subsidies to the fossil fuel industry, the oil depletion allowance, you know, on and on and on. Never mind the biggest subsidy of all, letting them pour carbon into the atmosphere for free, using the atmosphere as an open sewer for free. The fact that we give them subsidies at this point makes no sense at all. We've known how to burn coal and oil for 200 years. What are we subsidizing? What learning curve are they on? We should be subsidizing much more heavily than we are solar power and wind power and things, because we're absolutely dependent upon that as our bridge to a workable climate. It makes no sense to be subsidizing the rich. It makes great sense to be trying to speed up the quick adoption of energy we can live with.
And we have time for one or maybe two quick phone calls for Bill McKibben. Let's go to Stella in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Stella.
Hi. Bill and Kathleen and radio listeners, I'd like to share, please, a piece of the paradigm shift that you've been talking about, Bill, that we are in the process of accomplishing and need desperately to accomplish quickly. It's a quote from Gaylord Nelson that, when you ponder it, is extremely profound. And the quote is, "The economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment."
That couldn't be better put, and Gaylord Nelson put a lot of things the right way. You know, sometimes when you think about the way that policymakers talk about the economy, it's as if it's much more real to them than the physical world. We talk about the ailing economy, the recovering economy. The economy is, on the mend. It's almost as if it was a physical thing that we must cosset and coddle and whatever. But the natural world is just something out there that we can take for granted. Well, no more. I mean, we can't take it for granted, and at the rate we're going, the cost that it's going to exert on the economy as we destroy it is so enormous that it's almost impossible to calculate. The best effort came from the British economist Lord Stern, who a couple of years ago put out a report for the UK government saying that the cost of unchecked climate change would exceed World War I, World War II, and the Great Depression combined. So that gives you some sense of the magnitude that we're talking about. It's not going to be cheap to move to renewable energy, but it's a hell of a lot cheaper than dealing with that.
Bill, thank you ever so much for being with us again.
Kathleen, my pleasure. You do a very good thing here, and it's always fun to talk to your listeners.
Bill McKibben, our guest, he has a recent piece in The New Yorker, which you will want to read if you find him interesting, and I'm sure most of you do. He urges everybody to read the Pope's encyclical on climate, all 183 pages, instead of news clips about that. And we thank him for his time. He was chair of the environmental group 350.org, and he is the author of so many books. The one that was written 25 years ago was the first book, general interest book on climate change. So he really is a founder of the movement in many ways. Most recent book, Oil and Honey.